Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program, Module 2, Instructional Frameworks as Growth Pathways. So welcome to Module 2 of the Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. I'm Justin Bader, and in this module, we're going to talk about how to use different sets of shared expectations, which we call instructional frameworks, to help teachers grow. Now, the primary type of instructional framework that we're going to be working with in this program is, of course, your teacher evaluation criteria. However, as you'll see, often teacher evaluation criteria are not specific enough to help teachers grow in the precise areas where they need to focus. So in this module, we'll talk about how to use different types of instructional frameworks to create growth pathways for teachers. Here's a little bit about what we will be talking about. We'll look at four indicators of practices that are worth focusing on that will affect student learning the most so that you can choose areas of practice that are going to pay off for the effort involved. We're going to talk about how to help already good teachers and already great teachers keep on improving, even if they're already doing really, really well. We'll talk about how to use your evaluation criteria to design growth pathways for teachers who aren't meeting expectations as well. We'll talk about the three elements of fluency and how to help teachers attain proficiency in areas that they're struggling with. And we'll talk about how to tell if your expectations are high enough and how to raise them if you need to. So we will be doing quite a bit with evaluation criteria throughout the rest of this program, but in this module, we're specifically going to look at the interplay between those evaluation criteria and other types of instructional frameworks you might be using. It's important to point out, though, that beyond the scope of this module is the process of actually developing instructional frameworks. So if you're looking to build a new instructional framework from scratch, I'll refer you to my book, Mapping Professional Practice, and our flagship program, the Evidence-Driven Growth Pathways Certification Program. There's quite a bit involved in developing an instructional framework from scratch. There are some quick things you can do to articulate some growth pathways, and we'll talk about those in this module. But for the full experience, do check out those other resources. In this module, we'll be talking about frameworks in a couple of specific ways. We'll be talking about when to use them. We'll talk about how to use them as growth pathways and kind of which types of frameworks are good for different purposes, and we'll talk about when to consider developing your own. So with that, let's get into Module 2. Thanks so much for being part of this program. So what are instructional frameworks? In this module, we'll be looking at a definition of instructional frameworks. We'll look at some different types of instructional frameworks, and we'll talk about some different scenarios where you might need to use particular types of instructional frameworks. So let's start with a definition. This is from Mapping Professional Practice with my co-author, Heather Bell Williams. An instructional framework is a detailed description of the insider's view of professional practice in a specific area, and that's broken into key components and levels of fluency. Instructional frameworks can establish shared expectations, create growth pathways for teachers and other education professionals, and mobilize educators around a common vision for improvement. So when we talk about instructional frameworks, we're talking essentially about shared expectations, but in a particular format that has a lot of detail and that has a particular structure that lends itself to serving as that growth pathway that we want it to be. Now, of course, there are many different types of instructional frameworks, just a few of them that will be relevant to our work together. First of all, your teacher evaluation criteria are probably the most relevant example. You're going to be doing quite a bit of work with your teacher evaluation criteria, and we are going to treat those as largely fixed. I'm not going to recommend that you revise your teacher evaluation criteria or do away with them or get new ones. I'm going to assume that those are fixed by law or policy or contract, or at least longstanding tradition. So we'll keep those as they are, but we'll also be open to using other sources of shared expectations, other types of frameworks, like pedagogy that your staff has learned through professional development that you've done, through the curriculum that you've adopted. If there is a specific type of pedagogy that is specified or implied by your curriculum, we'll certainly want to refer to those expectations. If you have other expectations that have been developed at the district or school level for teacher practice, referring to those could be very productive. And you might, in some circumstances, want to develop situation-specific custom instructional frameworks to help people in particular areas. If they really need you to zoom in and help them see how to grow, a custom developed instructional framework could be just the ticket. Let's look first at evaluation frameworks, though, because that's where we're going to be spending most of our energy in the teacher evaluation process. There are quite a few different evaluation frameworks out there. Some of the most popular currently are Danielson, Marshall, and Marzano. You might also see work by James Strong and other authors out there. And of course, many states and districts and jurisdictions develop their own teacher evaluation criteria. South Australia has their own. If you're in a different country, you probably have criteria that are in use in your area. But for the most part, I'm going to be using examples from Danielson and Marshall's frameworks because they match the structure. They have the structure that we use in mapping professional practice of key components and levels of performance or levels of fluency. When you have that structure, your framework can serve as a growth pathway for teachers, and it can serve as a neutral third party to kind of settle arguments about what good performance is like and what constitutes subpar performance. We really want to avoid this battle of opinions that can happen where, you know, as a supervisor, you think someone could be better and they think they're perfectly fine, and we just end up butting heads or having kind of this tug of war over whether someone's practice is good enough. Often those conflicts and those struggles are counterproductive. So having a fixed standard as the arbiter of those disputes can be extremely useful. It's also extremely useful to have a common source of vocabulary, a shared language for talking about practice with precision, because often in our profession, we will use the same words, but not mean the same thing by them. You know, if two different schools are talking about differentiation, or two different people within the same school are talking about differentiated instruction, they may mean completely different things by that term that sounds the same, but looks very different in practice. So the level of detail that's present in an instructional framework is really helpful for making sure that we're not just using the same term, but actually talking about the same type of practice. Now, this is also useful at the level of an initiative or an improvement effort that's underway. So often schools will have frameworks that are specific to their school improvement initiatives. For example, Heather's school implemented zones of regulation prior to when we wrote Mapping Professional Practice. So that's one of the examples that we have in the book of an initiative-specific framework. And the nice thing about an initiative-specific instructional framework is that you can use it to help individuals grow, but you can also use it to assess your overall progress in implementing the initiative with fidelity. So those are very handy if you have them. It doesn't hurt to ask if you're not sure if something like that has already been created for a particular initiative or curriculum that you're adopting. It doesn't hurt to ask and get that at your fingertips. A third type of framework that we'll be looking at is a curriculum-specific framework. For example, the Next Gen Science Standards specify pedagogy, or at least imply specific types of pedagogy at certain points. The Common Core Standards do the same thing, where, you know, those are standards for student learning, but there are expectations for practice embedded in them. So that's definitely a good place to look, even though those standards are thought of as being for student learning. They're a great place to look for common expectations for professional practice. And we can also get more specific with custom frameworks. If you look at the way a teacher evaluation rubric is designed, often it describes the outcome in terms of the teacher's performance, but it doesn't describe what to do to get there. So sometimes people need more specific guidance to improve their practice in specific areas. And we'll talk a little bit in this module about how you can develop frameworks like that. For example, in the book, we have a few examples of situation-specific frameworks for Hannah, who is a student teacher, for another individual who is actually a student, for monitoring their own behavior at recess. I mean, these frameworks can be adapted to just about any situation. And in the next section, we're going to talk about the design features that allow them to be so useful in so many different situations. But the common denominator in all of them is specificity. When people need help improving, they need specific guidance. And if your evaluation criteria provide specific enough guidance in how to improve, great. If they don't, then we'll want to look at another type of instructional framework. So in the next section, let's take a look at the design features of instructional frameworks. Let's talk now about the design features of instructional frameworks. Instructional frameworks essentially look like rubrics, as you will see, but they have some particular features that distinguish them from other forms of shared expectations. Let's take a look. In the left column, you will notice what we call key components. And those key components typically are related to a particular area of practice. They're the components of that area of practice. And we recommend having from 3 to 5. And then in the remaining columns, you see the levels of fluency for each component. Now, this is probably somewhat what your teacher evaluation criteria look like, and that is not an accident. Our design for instructional frameworks that we use in mapping professional practice is heavily based on the teacher evaluation rubrics that are in place in most schools. And the Danielson framework is a great example. If you want to see a great teacher evaluation framework with 4 levels of performance and different domains and different components, Danielson is a great example. We wanted to highlight some specific features of those frameworks though. So let's take a look at key components and then levels of fluency. The key components, again, down the left-hand side, are 3 to 5 dimensions of professional judgment. They're not just arbitrary items that we put in a list. They really are the concepts or the dimensions of professional judgment that have to be juggled to be able to enact the practice. If any of those elements is missing, if any of those key components is not present in a teacher's practice, well, then they're not really doing that larger practice that we're talking about. If something is missing, the practice is not taking place. And that means that we're not talking about abstract concepts, abstract principles, values. We're not talking about steps. We're talking about the core dimensions of the thinking that the teacher has to do in order to enact the practice. Now, in terms of how key components are articulated, in some cases, they could just be a single word, and in other cases, they could be a short phrase. For example, in the very first framework we developed together, which was around behavior management for paraprofessionals, Heather ended up articulating the key components as phrases. And you can see them here, reinforces expectations for student behavior, appropriately responds to student misbehavior, uses proactive and prevention techniques, engages in respectful interactions, properly applies NCI. Each of those is something that the paraprofessional must do in order to manage behavior effectively. Those are key components of effective practice in that area. And if any of them is missing, then that staff member is not going to be effective in managing student behavior. These really are the essential key components. And again, they're articulated as phrases rather than single words. Now, this particular framework was not designed for teachers. As you can see, it's for parapros. And the scenario that prompted us to do some work together to talk about this and initially to get into the practice of writing instructional frameworks was that Heather could see that in her school, my co-author in Mapping Professional Practice, Heather Bell Williams, could see that some parapros were great at managing student behavior, and other people seemed to be lacking in some common sense. And they would say things that would set kids off, they would fail to do things that other people would do. And when she looked at the evaluation criteria for parapros, they said vague things like manages student behavior effectively. And that meant something different to everyone. So we decided to get a lot more specific, and this was the list that Heather came up with after observing effective and less effective parapros and just seeing what they did differently. And by articulating that list in some detail, she was able to be much more specific with people who were not meeting expectations and able to give them a growth pathway in the form of an instructional framework. So that's a kind of a more detailed list of key components that with more words in each component, but you could also have key components that are just a single word each. For example, in this framework, the key components are just a single word: standard, communication, milestones, scaffolding, inclusivity, and rigor. Those are dimensions of high expectations for student learning. And that was a framework that I developed in some work that I did with a high school principal who was looking to increase rigor. And we ultimately ended up making rigor just one of the 6 key components in that framework for high expectations. So you can approach these in different ways, and there can be different levels of detail. For example, if we look at the final key component in Heather's framework for parapros, properly applies nonviolent crisis intervention theory in practice, well, that could be a whole framework by itself. So to some extent, there's a degree of nesting in frameworks. We could also zoom in on just one of those components and probably make a whole framework for that. And you have to decide as you are using or developing a framework what the appropriate level of detail is. I'm going to recommend generally that you start with your teacher evaluation criteria, or if you're evaluating a different type of staff member, such as a parapro, whatever their evaluation criteria are, start there and then get more specific if you need to. If, like Heather found, your evaluation criteria are too vague, then you may need to come up with something more specific. But in general, we'll start with the criteria. So key components are down the left-hand side in the first column. The remaining columns are dedicated to the levels of fluency. And in an evaluation framework, those would be called levels of performance or the rating levels. You know, those could turn into a numeric rating for each area of practice. We recommend developing frameworks with four levels. And we recommend that for a couple of reasons. First, four tends to be enough, enough to distinguish between different levels of performance. You could go five, you could go six, but at some point we're making distinctions without a difference. It's enough. And also, most evaluation systems now use four levels. So it's a familiar format, it's a familiar number of steps, and typically it's enough. Now, we call them beginning, developing, fluent, and exemplary. Because not all frameworks are for evaluation, we didn't call one of them satisfactory or proficient, none of them are called unsatisfactory. We really wanted to emphasize the developmental nature of those stages or those levels of fluency. So you might have some levels that are called unsatisfactory in your evaluation framework. That is fine. But we really are emphasizing the idea of starting at the beginning and taking the next step and moving all the way up to fluent or proficient, and possibly even beyond that to exemplary, or what Danielson calls distinguished. Now, a big difference between levels of fluency in instructional frameworks and levels of performance on other types of rubrics is that there is a qualitative difference between the levels. People are enacting different practices. People are attending to different things with greater and greater nuance and sophistication as you go up the levels. They're not simply doing more of the same or hitting more of the components of a checklist. For example, this is a kind of familiar format for a checklist rubric. We call this a checklist rubric. This is not really what we're talking about with an instructional framework, where two of the checklist items are present at level one. To get to level two, you have to add a third, and then to get to level three, you have to add a fourth, and then ultimately at level four, you add all five components of the checklist. That's not really what we're talking about just doing more things to move up. We're really talking about a difference in sophistication. For example, in our high expectations framework, we had six key components, and for one of them, these are the descriptions. And I'm not going to read all of them to you. You can see them on the screen here. But notice that each description gets longer, but not like a checklist gets longer. There is a real qualitative difference between those levels of fluency. For example, at level two, the teacher to some degree aligns expectations with standards, but there are misalignments that allow the student to meet the teacher's expectations without actually meeting the standard, or vice versa. At level three, the teacher closely aligns expectations with standards and communicates to students and so on. There's more nuance there that's present at level three. So the practice really is different from one level to the next. And what we're seeing develop as a teacher moves from one level to the next is professional judgment. This is not just about observable behavior. It's not about things that you can easily check off on a list. It's about the teacher's own thinking and judgment. In the next section, we'll talk about that judgment, and we'll talk about how to take an insider's view of practice. Let's talk now about the insider's view of practice and how to capture that hard-to-observe heart of teaching. Now, teaching is largely a matter of professional judgment, right? When we improve teaching, we are improving professional judgment. And a lot of what matters is not directly observable. It is hard for us to see and hard for us to document what really matters in teaching. The thinking, the judgment, the decision-making, all of those are elements of practice that can really only be seen from the inside. And it is by nature that they are hidden and hard to observe. It's kind of like an iceberg, right? An iceberg is about 90% submerged. 90% of an iceberg is below the surface of the water. And if we look only at the surface features of an iceberg, we will get the wrong idea about what we're looking at. If we think, well, what I can see is all there is, well, we're going to be very wrong about what we're actually looking at. And I think teaching is largely the same way, that about 90% of teaching practice is not directly observable. It's hidden beneath the surface. It's things like planning and assessment, the teacher's background knowledge, the teacher's knowledge of students, their knowledge of pedagogy, their thinking, their decision-making, their professional judgment. All of that is hidden and not directly observable to us. So we have to be a little bit thoughtful about how we use evidence to figure out what's in that 90% that we can't directly see. Our goal here is to gain the insider's view, to see what the teacher sees, not what the observer sees. And we have to ask ourselves a better question, not what does it look like? What does proficient practice look like from an observer's standpoint? But what does successful practice look like from the teacher's perspective? From the perspective of the person enacting the practice, what is it like? What does it feel like to be practicing at a specific level? That needs to be our focus. And that has big implications for how we use observation and how we use evidence in the classroom. We have to be mindful of a tendency that we call observability bias. And I'll share the definition that Heather and I use in mapping professional practice. Observability bias is our tendency to focus on what's easiest to observe rather than teacher thinking, right? Rather than use empathy and put ourselves in the teacher's shoes to think about, okay, what are the factors they're considering? What are they juggling? What are they keeping in mind? What are the key components of their judgment as they are teaching this class? If we step out of their shoes and just look at what's on our checklist, then we're going to miss a lot of what really matters in terms of their teaching. And you can see this if you look at a quality observation and evaluation rubric like Danielson. Danielson's evaluation system is used more than any other. You know, the majority of US states use Danielson, and many other states have evaluation rubrics that are based on Danielson, like Texas uses T-tests. You know, Danielson is everywhere. And notice how little of Danielson is directly observable. Now, domain 2 and 3 are fairly observable. You know, you can see the learning environment, you can see learning experiences, you can see communicating with students, engaging students, maintaining positive student, you know, supporting positive student behavior and all that. But domains 1 and domains 4, and really even parts of domains 2 and 3, are not directly observable. So, you know, my contention is that only about 10% of what really matters in teaching is directly observable. The rest we have to get at indirectly. It's not observable behavior that matters. It's the teacher's thinking and professional judgment that is the heart of teaching. When we improve teaching, we're doing so by through the lever of improving their professional judgment. And that means it's so crucial for us to capture that insider's view of practice and get a sense of what the teacher is not only doing and saying, but what they are thinking and how they're thinking. And the best way to get insight into that insider's view of practice is to get the teacher to tell us, right? To get them to explain their thinking, explain their actions, tell us what they're thinking, share with us how they're processing. And we're not going to get fully into this right now, but just briefly, our main strategy for doing that is to ask evidence-driven questions. So we do have some evidence when we get into classrooms, when we do walkthroughs or observations, we can notice things that we can bring up and we can say, tell me about that. You know, we can ask people to elaborate. And the most important thing we can do then is to stop talking, to stop trying to give suggestions and to just listen. Get the teacher talking, because that is how you are going to get the insider's view of practice. And if you get good at this, you don't even have to ask a complete question. You can ask a broken question, like, just tell me about how I saw that you handed back the papers and had students review their work. Talk to me about how you're using that to, you know, and you can kind of trail off and allow the teacher to run in a productive direction with their thinking about that area of practice. Now, if you would like some more specific questions, we have 10 that you can use on the back of our note cards. You can download those at the link you see on the screen. Those 10 questions will get you focused on evidence and will allow you to send the teacher in a very specific direction and ask a more specific question, but it's also fine to ask a kind of open-ended question and just see where the teacher takes it, because that's going to allow you to kind of figure out where their thinking is. And when we're interested in professional judgment, an interesting thing happens. We can actually figure out where someone is. If we have a high quality framework and we are asking good questions and we're working with evidence, we can actually figure out where someone is from as few as one observations. A single observation is often enough to figure out where someone is on a good framework. It's kind of like if you have an out-of-town guest who's trying to find their way to your house, they might call you and say, hey, I'm kind of lost. Can you give me some sense of how to kind of find your house? I'm not really sure if I'm in the right place. I'm not sure if I'm close. What you would do is you would say, well, tell me what you see. You would give them some landmarks and say, hey, have you passed the 65 turnoff yet? Are you at mile marker such and such? Or have you seen the gas station sign? You would ask them for some landmarks. And in an instructional framework, the key components and the levels of fluency contain landmarks that are going to allow you to locate the teacher's practice on that framework. But the goal here is to figure out where they are, not to give a score. Now, we are, of course, are going to give ratings at the end of the school year. The evaluation process does include giving ratings, giving scores to people in particular areas of practice. But that's not our first goal. Our first goal is to figure out where people are so that we can figure out what they need next. Our goal is triangulation and location, not scoring. And of course, sometimes people are in between levels. You know, you might say, are you at exit 63 or 64? And they might say, well, I don't know. I think I'm kind of in between them. Well, the same is true of teacher practice. People can be in between levels and have some characteristics of, say, level 2, some characteristics of level 3. That's maybe where they mostly are. Maybe they have some characteristics of level 4. It is okay for people to not fully fit within one level of performance or fluency. So what you might do in that case, if you see that somebody has characteristics of multiple levels, is just pin all of those levels of your criteria on the screen and say, okay, we're a little bit 2, a little bit 3, a little bit 4. Look at all of those and figure out where to focus in your feedback with the teacher to help them move solidly to that next level of fluency. And of course, you can do all of that if you have a good instructional framework. Over the next couple of sections of this module, we're going to look at how we can use frameworks and evidence at 4 different stages of the supervision, feedback, and evaluation process. First, the level of capturing evidence. You know, what we document in the first place can be improved by using our instructional frameworks. We can use that same language to discuss what we saw, to have feedback conversations. We can use it in our observation reports, our formal write-ups of what we saw, and we can use it in making our final evaluation ratings. So with that, in the next section, we will begin talking about how we can capture evidence using the language of our instructional framework. Let's talk now about using framework language to capture rich evidence of practice. As we just saw, there are 4 distinct stages at which we can use our shared expectations, our teacher evaluation criteria, or our other instructional framework expectations. And those are at the stage of capturing evidence, discussing it with teachers, describing practice in writing, and ultimately issuing a rating. And in this section, we're going to talk about how to capture evidence that is aligned with expectations in the form of low inference notes. Now, taking evidence-rich low inference notes is critical because it's those notes that are going to allow us to kind of reconstruct what happened during the lesson when we're talking with the teacher, and it's going to allow us to focus on the right things if we've taken good notes that are aligned with our criteria. To do that, we want to make sure that we're leaving out any kind of commentary. We want to leave out any kind of judgment. We don't want to say this was good or this is bad or this is satisfactory or things like that. We want to really stick to the facts and describe them as richly as possible with verbatim quotes and descriptions of what's happening, and even timestamps and frequency counts, or, you know, the number of students who are doing X or the number of students who are, engaged or on task. We want to be as descriptive as possible. And you can do that in our repertoire app using the notes feature. If you expand the snippet box, you will see our note-taking tools, and you can turn on timestamps and line breaks and minutes and seconds and get very, very detailed moment-by-moment notes about what's going on. You can capture direct quotes, and you can notice things that you want to kind of zoom in a little bit more and focus on. For example, let's say a class is working on an assignment, and one student has not gotten started. They're just kind of fidgeting and not really doing their work. The teacher might come around to that student. You might take some notes about what is happening. The student is fidgeting, not working on the problems. Teacher approaches, points at the first problem, and the student begins working. All right, pretty simple, straightforward, low inference note there, but there's a lot that could be going on that can help us capture the right kind of evidence that's going to be useful later. But we're not going to do that if we prematurely make judgments. We really need to put off making the judgments about how good or bad something was, because if we form a judgment too soon, it's going to actually lower the quality of the evidence that we're capturing. We don't want to second guess what we're doing. We don't want to, what the teacher's doing. We don't want to come up with suggestions in the moment. We just want to take in what is happening. And yet we're not going to just turn off our professional judgment completely, right? We're not going to say, I'm just a dumb tape recorder. I don't know anything. No, we're going to keep using our professional judgment, but we're going to use it to guide our attention rather than to evaluate at this stage. We're going to defer the judgment and the rating and the feedback and the what I would have done differently kind of thoughts until later, and just use our professional judgment to guide our attention. And we can use our evaluation criteria as kind of a set of lenses. I saw an interesting product the other day called Fungi's, a set of sunglasses that make it easier to spot morels. And I'm not sure if you have ever tried a morel. I don't know if I've ever had a morel, but I hear they're good and I know they're a delicacy. And apparently you can wear a certain type of sunglasses and do a better job of spotting morels because of the color of the lenses just makes them pop out. And I think that's a good metaphor for how shared expectations work in the observation process. When we have the right language in mind, we can see things, we can see details that are going to pop out at us that we would otherwise miss. And it's going to be much easier to notice the right things and document the right things if we have the right criteria in mind as we observe. And it's much easier to do that in real time than it is after the fact, right? Like those glasses for finding morels don't work if you don't put them on until after you get home, right? You have to wear them while you're looking, while you're out collecting. And it's the same for us. If we only use our evaluation criteria after the fact, we're going to have failed to document some important things because we didn't notice them. So what we want to do instead is take those low inference notes with our criteria in mind. In repertoire, you can do that by pinning relevant snippets. So if you're taking some low inference notes and you think, boy, I'm seeing a lot about behavior or distractions or disruptions, how do I, what do I want to say about that? You can pin some things that you want to be sure to mention to the teacher. And that is going to allow you to really put things all together when you're talking with the teacher afterward. If you have those criteria in mind as you're observing, and if you are taking notes with those criteria in mind. So some of what we've talked about here, here's how we're going to do this in repertoire, how we're going to document evidence that aligns with specific expectations and even uses the language from those expectations. And again, this feature is called pinned snippets in repertoire. You simply decide what you're focusing on, do a little bit of a keyword search in your snippet box and pull up some criteria that are relevant. You might try a couple of different words, pin a couple of different criteria, and then continue taking your notes as you keep those criteria in mind. And then whenever you need to shift your focus, you can do so. So if you're just doing a quick walkthrough, you might not shift your focus. You might just decide what you're going to focus on, pin some criteria, take some notes with those criteria in mind, and then it's over. If you're doing a longer observation though, where you're seeing a sequence of different learning activities and the students are doing different things at different points in the lesson, different criteria may become relevant and you can pin and unpin them at any time. So here is how you do that kind of step by step. First, again, you do a keyword search to pull up a relevant subject and find some criteria that are relevant. And then you want to pin the criteria that align with what you see as probably the teacher's current practice. And you know, if the teacher's proficient, you can pin the proficient descriptor there. And of course, we're not putting too much effort into actually rating the teacher here. We're just trying to kind of get a sense of where things fall, and we're trying to create some alignment to get a sense of where we are. We're orienting ourselves to where the teacher's practice is and how that aligns with the criteria. You can also pin one level up. So if we think the teacher's probably at kind of a proficient level now, let's look a level up and see what would be next if that teacher were to continue to grow in that area of practice. You can also try different keywords. You know, if you're looking for behavior, that might catch some things. You might also look for words like disruption or disrupted and pin those as well. And you want to just use this as an ongoing cycle as you observe of taking things in, searching for and pinning relevant criteria, taking low inference notes using the language of those criteria and keeping those criteria in mind, and then continuing to shift your focus as the lesson unfolds. And if you're not using Repertoire to do that currently, it is included with this program. So go ahead and go to dashboard.principalcenter.com/repertoire for instructions on how to get started. And please reach out to our team if we can help. We're happy to help get you started using Repertoire to take high quality, low inference notes, because that's what's going to enable you to have aligned feedback conversations with the teacher. So the notes are critical for going into that next step, which is the conversation, which we'll talk about in the next section. How can we use framework language in our feedback conversations? As we saw in the last section, it's incredibly powerful to not only use your evaluation criteria at the end of the process, when you're doing all the paperwork at the end of the evaluation and observation process, but if you use those criteria from the very beginning, from the very first moment you step foot into the classroom and start taking notes about what's going on, then everything that follows from that can take advantage of the increased quality of the notes that you've taken, and you can continue to use that framework language. And of course, the next step is the feedback conversation with the teacher. After you observe, it is incredibly important to talk with the teacher and make further sense of what you saw and practice using that framework language in your conversations. Now, a word of caution here, the evaluation criteria themselves are not especially good as feedback phrases that you can just quote to the teacher. So you don't just want to say, well, you are at level 3, student behavior is generally appropriate, blah, 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 and just kind of read the criterion to the teacher. That's not going to work very well for a couple of reasons. First, evaluation criteria are written as generalizations. They characterize the teacher's overall practice over the scope of the entire school year, and an individual walkthrough or observation is not really an appropriate unit of analysis here. So they're kind of big picture, they're kind of broad, and they have some awkward phrasing that's just not going to feel like a good feedback phrase. And they often don't feel like they directly line up to the evidence. We have to do that work of connecting the criteria to the evidence. And probably there are going to be too many things to talk about at once. So what we want to do, we want to use these criteria to guide our conversations without just quoting them directly to the teacher. You want to say things like, hey, I noticed, and then share something you noticed. Put the evidence in and describe what you saw or what you noticed. And you want to help the other person see the patterns of cause and effect that you are seeing using specific terms from the evaluation criteria. But again, our goal is not to provide a rating. We said in the last section that you want to kind of locate the teacher's practice on your rubric, on your criteria, but not for the purpose of judgment, not for the purpose of issuing a rating and saying this person is definitely at a level 3. No, we're just trying to kind of figure out where we are and get a sense of how the criteria align with the evidence. So we need to see any judgments we make about where we think the teacher's practice is level-wise. We need to see those as very tentative and subject to revision as we talk with the teacher about their practice. And the best way to talk about the practice is just one thing at a time. For example, you might notice that the teacher's response is very proportionate. You might look at your evaluation criteria and say, wow, yeah, she really does keep things proportionate when she's responding to off-task behavior. And you might say something like, hey, I noticed when you're responding to a student who's off-task and not doing their work, you do a really good job of not escalating things. You're bringing it down with your reaction. Like when you used eye contact when Ethan blurted out, you know, you didn't make a big deal of that. You didn't call across the room. You were just very, very low key. Talk to me about what you're doing to get ahead of behaviors like that. And you can just, from that point, let the teacher talk. So you're taking one key word from your criteria that you noticed is relevant, that you captured relevant evidence in your notes for, and you're asking the teacher to elaborate and to share their thinking, but you're doing so with the next level criteria in mind too. If you've pinned those next level criteria, you might notice a phrase like subtle and preventive. That's level 4 in this particular framework. So you might ask a question that maybe doesn't quote that directly, but says, what are you doing to get ahead of? That's that preventive idea. get ahead of behaviors like that. And since you know what the person is already doing well, they're already being subtle, you might have to ask yourself, okay, what's the next step? Well, being a little bit more preventive. So what you're essentially doing there is you're coaching them toward the next level. You're helping them see where they are and where they need to go next in that feedback conversation, guided by the notes and the evaluation criteria. In the next section, we'll talk about how to use that language of your evaluation criteria in writing, in any kind of report or final evaluation that you do. Let's talk now about how we can use framework language in our written observation reports and evaluations. It is incredibly powerful to have used consistent language at every stage of the process, from actually observing and taking our low inference notes to talking with the teacher and making sense of what we saw and just having a rich feedback conversation to ultimately documenting that in the form of observation reports and final evaluations. The consistency of our language will serve us well at every stage. So let's talk about how we can translate some of this into the kind of higher stakes and more official writing that comes out of this process. At the low end of seriousness and detail, if you are doing informal observations, informal classroom walkthroughs, just a quick pop-in, a brief conversation, we probably don't want to do a lot of written feedback in that context. We want to document the conversation, you know, record the date on your note cards or in an app, just, you know, record the fact that you showed up, but we probably don't need a lot of detailed written feedback. You do want to take notes in most cases, you know, unless you're just getting started, you probably want to take some notes so that you have something specific to talk about. But those notes are not really suggestions or other types of feedback. There's no kind of evaluative language. It's just a documentation of what you saw and evidence that you can talk about without any kind of rating or judgment applied to it. Again, we want to defer judgment as long as possible, and especially until after the feedback conversation. You know, if you are doing a formal observation, you're going to take those notes. The notes are going to be low inference. You're going to provide them to the teacher and talk with the teacher about what you observed, but only after you talk should we have any kind of written feedback or evaluative language going on. So after the conversation, you can do the post-observation report. You know, I personally would not do this if it's not required. I don't think there's a huge value in the written report. I think the notes themselves are the most valuable, but in a lot of cases you're required to do an observation report. And what I would emphasize in that observation report, if you're required to do one, is the low inference notes. Do not, if you can at all avoid applying any kind of judgment or rating, just leave that out. Leave the rating out. Save that for the year-end evaluation. Because again, the specific observation is not the correct unit of analysis for evaluation. We're judging a teacher's overall practice for the entire year, not a single lesson. And I'm going to guess that your teacher evaluation criteria are called teacher evaluation criteria, not lesson scoring criteria. Like, the idea of scoring a lesson, one single observation, is very different from the idea of evaluating a teacher's overall practice. So we want to put off those judgments and evaluations to the very end of the process as much as possible. And yet we want to use our observation reports to make sure that we have our evidence lined up. So if at the end of the year we do need to defend a particular claim about the teacher's practice, then the evidence has been there all along. We want to use specific terminology from our evaluation criteria whenever it's appropriate. We want to make sure that we're collecting evidence that is aligned with those criteria. And we want to maintain a continuous sense of where we think the teacher's practice is. Even though we're not rating it, we do want to locate it and make sure we always know where we are and where we think we're headed next. And again, we don't want to issue a rating of the individual observation. That is really not how these systems are designed. And if you are required to do that in your school or district, I want to encourage you to rethink that and maybe start some conversations about what the appropriate unit of scoring is. Really, it needs to be the entire school year. It needs to be the teacher's overall practice, not that one observation, because you're going to see different things in different observations that are going to change your opinion of where the teacher's practice is. You know, just for the simple reason that, you know, anybody can have an off day. Any lesson can be atypical, and that can go in either direction. We've all probably seen the dog and pony show lessons that are just so different and special and exceptional that they really bear no resemblance to the teacher's normal practice. And you know, teachers kind of put extra effort into those dog and pony show formal observation lessons. And we've seen it go the other way, where we know someone is capable, but they are just having a bad day. So the point is not to catch them on any particular type of day, but to really get an authentic sense of what their overall practice is like. So we want to put off that scoring as much as possible, work to change a system that requires you to score things prematurely. And we really just want to focus on evidence and understanding and using that framework language all along the way. And in the next section, we'll talk about how to use that language when writing those final evaluations. Let's talk now about using framework language in those final evaluation ratings using the GSIR format. We said earlier in this module that we can use framework language at every stage of the observation and evaluation process, from the moment we're observing and capturing notes to talking about those notes with the teacher to providing written feedback or a formal observation report, and ultimately, which we're going to talk about now, writing the final evaluation rating. At the end of the teacher evaluation process comes the actual evaluation, and we can write that evaluation in a particular way, you know, regardless of what template or what form or what app you do your evaluations in. The language of your written evaluations matters a great deal, particularly if you expect that the evaluation is going to be contested in any way. If your boss is going to look it over with a fine-tooth comb, if the teacher is going to take it very seriously and maybe take it to their union rep and contest any aspect of that evaluation, you want to make sure that it is airtight. So in this section, we're going to introduce a format for writing airtight final evaluations called GSIR. And GSIR is based on a couple of different sources. One is the work of John Safier, who in the early 1990s wrote a book called How to Make Supervision and Evaluation Really Work, in which he introduced and popularized the acronym CEIJ for Claim, Evidence, Impact, and Judgment. And I was never actually introduced to John Safier's work until long after I was a principal, until after I had written my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership. But it's been a very influential book in our profession in putting CEIJ, which I had heard of just without reference to John Safier, putting that out there into the world and making that part of the kind of craft knowledge of the profession. But it also reflects some insights from fields beyond educational leadership. You know, even the next gen science standards use this idea of claims backed by evidence and connected by reasoning. Today's science students are expected to use CER, claim, evidence, reasoning formats in their writing and in their argumentation. So we've adapted from those sources to bring you the GSIR model. And GSIR stands for Generalization, Specifics, Impact, and Rating. And if we have each of those four ingredients in our final evaluations, they're going to be airtight because these four pieces work together very well, as we'll talk about now. First, the generalization is a generalization or a characterization of the teacher's practice in a specific area. So first, we need to recognize that we're going to have multiple GSIR statements for an overall evaluation. For example, if you have four domains of practice in which you evaluate teachers, you're going to have four GSIR arguments, one argument for each domain. And if you do evaluations differently, you might not need that many, or if you have more domains in which you need to evaluate teachers, let's say you have seven domains or overall areas of practice, you might need to have seven separate GSIR arguments. But the generalization part of it is a generalization in the sense that we're evaluating the teacher's overall practice throughout the entire school year. We're not evaluating or rating or scoring a single lesson or a single observation or a single piece of evidence, and we're not saying that that is what is satisfactory or unsatisfactory or basic or developing or whatever. We are looking at the teacher's overall practice and characterizing it in a particular way that we will later rate. Now, to back that generalization, we're going to provide specific evidence and examples. I like to have at least one example if it's a positive characterization. If we're saying something nice, one piece of evidence is good, two is better, and two is really necessary if we are making a negative claim. If we are claiming that someone is not meeting expectations, if they're unsatisfactory or below proficient or whatever the rating may be, that's not great. We want to make sure we're backing that with multiple pieces of evidence and examples with specifics from our observations. Then we want to really connect the dots for the reader and explain the impact of that practice on relevant outcomes. For example, if we are saying that someone's planning is inadequate, we want to not just say that their planning is unsatisfactory and give examples of that. We want to say how it is impacting the classroom environment, how it is impacting students and their learning. And we do that because we want to free ourselves from any accusation of nitpicking or being arbitrary or just picking on the teacher. We really want to focus on the impact on students of the practice as it currently exists. So we want to really connect the dots for people. And then ultimately, we can give the rating. Now, this type of writing, where you're connecting the dots between the evidence and a general statement that evidence supports, and then an impact on practice, and then a rating. The really nice thing about doing that hard work is that you get to figure out if you're right in advance. You can tell in advance if your argument is going to hold water when people start poking at it, when people start criticizing it and looking over your shoulder and saying, hey, do you really have evidence that this teacher is unsatisfactory or is not meeting expectations? You can tell if you're making a good argument when you use the GSIR format. And if you realize that your evidence is not strong enough, you can avoid putting yourself in the unenviable position of making an argument that you cannot support. So this is a good exercise to go through even before you're writing the final evaluation and say to yourself, okay, where do I think this person is? Do I have evidence of that? Can I explain what the impact is? And then can I justify a rating that maybe is not great? Make sure that you can do that before you conclude that you're done with an evaluation. And sometimes the answer is you need to get more evidence. You might need to go back to a classroom, do an additional observation. Usually that's an option, but you might need to find a way to just work in more evidence if you're finding that you're having difficulty supporting your generalization. And in some cases, that additional evidence will lead you to revise your conclusions, to actually come to a different generalization about the teacher's practice and a different rating. So that's a good outcome too, if you end up with a more accurate rating as a result of searching for more evidence. So a couple of phrases that you can use to include each of these components in your final evaluations. To make a generalization, you can say, in the area of classroom management, Mrs. Smith's practice is characterized by, and then generalize, you know, give some characteristics of that practice. Maybe she's a warm demander. Maybe Mrs. Smith has a sense of humor and respect or something, you know, come up with a generalization there. Then you give some examples, some specifics, at least two or more if you're saying something negative. Then you explain the impact and say, as a result, you know, as a result of Mrs. Smith's warm classroom management style, students are always blah, blah, blah. And then you give the rating. Therefore, Mrs. Smith's practice in domain 2, the classroom environment, is best described as level 3 proficient. And it all fits together nicely if you've done a good job at each of those stages and you've used evidence and expectations appropriately. Now, to help you with this format, we have a tool called the GSIR Final Evaluation Builder, where this format with multiple options and multiple kind of descriptions and characterizations of practice is available to you in Repertoire. So if you look in Repertoire, search for the template GSIR Final Evaluation Builder, and you'll see an example there, and you can customize that with your own domains and your own descriptions, and you can put in the teacher's name and so forth. And we'll talk much more about how to do this and how to write this type of final evaluation in Module 4. So stay tuned for Module 4, where we'll go into much more depth on writing those airtight final evaluations. And prior to that, of course, we'll talk more about the formal observations. We've got a bit more to wrap up here in Module 2, though, so I'll see you in the next section.
Formal and informal growth pathways, using frameworks to help teachers improve. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit and get away from the formal evaluation process and think about how instructional frameworks can be useful for helping people grow outside of that process. Often when we're working with teachers who are focused on different areas, you know, we have some things that are relevant to evaluation criteria, but other people are working on things that might fall completely outside of your evaluation criteria. And certainly we want to help people succeed in every area covered by those criteria, but we also want to be mindful of opportunities to help people grow in other areas. So let's look at a variety of different sources for framework language. Of course, we've got a criteria that we'll use for all formal observations and evaluations, but you probably also have professional development that you've done. You have curriculum that you've adopted. You have expectations that you've developed as a staff, and you may even have individual expectations that you've set with particular teachers to help them grow in areas of need. So we're going to look at some opportunities and some different types of frameworks that you might choose to develop outside of your evaluation criteria. But I want to be very clear that evaluations themselves should always be centered on evaluation criteria. The frameworks we develop to support teacher growth in other areas will never take the place of evaluation criteria when it comes to the formal evaluations and observations that we do. So we're going to look now at how we can kind of go beyond them and help teachers understand how to improve their practice in particular areas. Because as great as it is to have clear teacher evaluation criteria, often they're not very specific about how to improve in specific areas. And especially if you are focused on a particular technique or a particular whole school reform, there is likely a great need for specificity in how to succeed with that reform. So we're going to look at a couple of different ways to do that. And we have to help people understand that it's not just a matter of switching to better techniques or of doing the same old techniques better. Low performance, you know, if we have opportunities where we could be doing much better, that could come from one of two places: either doing things that are not the best things to do, or doing things in a way that is not as good as it could be. So there's both the poor technique side and the using the technique poorly opportunity for improvement. We can address one or both of those. And in all cases, instructional frameworks are going to help by providing clarity about what practice looks like at increasing levels of fluency. We're going to paint a very clear picture of what the practice is like that can serve as a roadmap to help someone improve. And that vision that comes from the roadmap is critical, because often when people are making a change from, say, an old practice that wasn't as effective to a newer practice that's supposed to be more effective, their own personal effectiveness seems to go down. And we call this the implementation dip. When you're switching to something new that's unfamiliar, you're not as good as it yet. And people can get trapped in that implementation dip and say, wait a minute, this new practice is not as good as the old practice, so let's go back to the old practice. And what's really happening there at the bottom of that implementation dip is that people still need to climb the learning curve. They need to persist. They need to have a vision for what improved practice is going to look like so that they can reach that destination of being better at the better practice than they were at the old practice, but it takes some work. So we're going to make that vision clear with an instructional framework, and that framework is going to break down that practice into key components, probably 3 to 5 key components, and 4 levels of fluency. Now, those levels of fluency describe steps on the journey. They describe the steps that the person will take to improve their practice. And roughly, here's what those steps look like. Level 1 is just getting started. When somebody is first trying the new practice, here's what it looks like. Probably not very impressive yet, probably not getting great results, but we have to start somewhere. And getting people to take action is the first step. From there, we move on to level 2, where people are trying every aspect of the practice. They're trying to balance and integrate every component of the practice, but it's still very clunky, it's pretty rough, and it's still not getting results. And again, this is where people tend to give up. When they get to level 2, they're like, I'm doing everything, I'm trying, I am checking off everything on the list, but it's still not working. I'm still not getting better results than I did with the old way of doing things. And that's where we have to keep people's eyes focused on level 3 and beyond, because that's where the results come in. When we reach level 3, which we call fluent, that's where we start to see results. When everything starts to click, everything starts to fire on all cylinders, and people's efforts really start to pay off. And then beyond that, optionally, we can move to level 4 and pursue a vision for the best state-of-the-art practice that exists anywhere. Now, what I thought what we would do as we finish up this module is look at a couple of examples from the book Mapping Professional Practice. And I've drawn these from our training called Evidence-Driven Growth Pathways. And these will serve as just examples of the kinds of things that you might want to develop custom frameworks for that fall outside of your evaluation criteria. So a couple examples that we go through in the Growth Pathways certification. This was a school-wide framework that was developed for guided math, and we're not going to take the time to read each of those, but you can see this framework focused on the lessons in the curriculum, differentiation, classroom format, and assessment. Another school-wide framework that we talk about in Mapping Professional Practice is my co-author's Zones of Regulation framework. And the key components there you can see are language from the Zones of Regulation SEL curriculum, materials, lessons, student self-regulation, and adult self-regulation. And then there are level descriptions for each of those. But we can also have frameworks for individual teachers. So I'll show you two frameworks that were developed for individual teachers to create unique growth pathways for them in areas where they needed help that was more specific than the evaluation criteria provided. So first, let's take a look at Todd's framework. By the way, all of these are in the appendices to Mapping Professional Practice. Todd was a third grade teacher who was struggling with just kind of the flow of his classroom, classroom management. So you see the three areas that are outlined in detail there are student materials, student transitions, and student attention or focus. And then there's space where two other issues are identified but not addressed yet. Sometimes we want to take things a few at a time and not try to tackle too much at once. And you can also see that level four there is blanked out. There's nothing under the exemplary column because we don't necessarily want to overwhelm Todd if he's struggling with some of the fundamentals. We don't need level four necessarily to help Todd reach that fluent level. Another framework developed for an individual teacher is this one for Hannah, who was an intern, a pre-service teacher. And she was learning how to, you know, just lead the class with her tone of voice, how to manage transitions, how to give direct instruction with SFI, stand, focus, and instruct. And the specifics here in this framework were really what she needed to get these areas of her practice under control. Now, these would not be things that you focus on with everyone. These would be too basic for many of your staff members. But often it's very helpful to be extremely clear and explicit when someone needs guidance in a very particular area of practice that's more detailed than you'd find in your evaluation criteria. Now, one more example. This is from the secondary level, and this is more of a school-wide framework for high expectations. I developed this after working with a high school principal on some aspects and elements of high expectations, and here's just part of it. This one ended up being quite long, but you can see the rigor component has four level descriptions, and this helps you get kind of a shared vision for rigor across your entire staff. So it may be that you want to develop a framework that falls outside of your evaluation criteria, but that outlines specific expectations for practice in a particular area. In the next section, I'll walk you through some criteria for choosing such a focus. So I'll see you there. Choosing a focus, four criteria to maximize your impact on learning. In this section, we're going to look at some criteria for deciding what to develop a framework for. So in the last section, we talked about how frameworks can be helpful for your entire staff, getting everybody on the same page, or even for helping individuals improve in specific areas, because they allow us to be specific in ways that perhaps your evaluation criteria are not. They allow us to go into more depth and provide more detail as to how people can improve their practice in specific areas. But what we don't want to do, and I want to specifically caution you against this, is develop a giant handbook covering every area of practice. Like if you were to look at your evaluation criteria and say, well, I'm going to be much more specific about everything in this framework, what you would find is that process is extremely time consuming and not very productive. So I really want to encourage you to prioritize, to choose practices that specific people need help with or that your entire staff needs help with, and really focus on those and not try to develop kind of a binder full of frameworks that you might use if they're necessary. I want to encourage you to develop frameworks that people need immediately that you can use right away, because you're going to need to use a framework in order to finish developing it. So here are four criteria to help you choose the right focus for your framework. They are high frequency, high variability, high impact, and high leverage. Let's go through them one at a time here. First, high frequency means that it's something that happens a lot. It's not just for one unit, it's not just for one brief part of the year, but it's used pretty much constantly throughout the year in a variety of settings. And it's easy to miss things that that perhaps happen behind the scenes. As we've seen with observability bias, it can be tempting to focus on things that are easy for administrators and coaches to observe and easy to overlook things that teachers do on their own, like planning. So don't overlook planning. Anything that happens behind the scenes could be very, very high leverage if it is high frequency. The second criterion is high variability. We want to focus on and develop frameworks for practices that have a wide range of effectiveness from teacher to teacher that, you know, some people are doing really well with and other people are perhaps struggling more with. If everybody's already doing great, well, we probably don't need a framework. It's probably not worth focusing on. If everyone is doing rather poorly at something, You can still develop a framework for it, but you may need to look outside of your school. You may need to spend some time visiting classrooms in other schools where you see that the practice is being implemented successfully. And this is especially the case if you're implementing a new whole school model or adopting a new curriculum. It's often very helpful to do site visits and see proficient people using the approach or the curriculum that you are switching to. So you want to look for variation. That variation is going to give you your leveled descriptors and help you see what the growth pathway is like to go from just getting started at level one all the way up to fluent at level three and even state of the art at level four. And that can really help bring everybody up to level three or beyond. The third criterion is high impact. We want to choose practices that will really make a difference. And this is where we have to be mindful that we all have pet peeves. We all have things that we like to have done a certain way, that when we were in the classroom, we did a certain way, and it just kind of bothers us if people do it differently. But we want to not allow that to guide our decision making. We really want to focus on things that are going to make a big difference to student learning and not just be just something that's kind of irritating to us. So we've got to really look at practices that do need to be done a certain way in order to have the necessary impact on student learning. Finally, we need to choose practices that have high leverage for us as leaders. They need to be things that are within our power to influence in a reasonable time frame. So a non-example of that would be something that takes a great deal of time and outside resources to develop. For example, if you have math teachers who are lacking in content knowledge, let's say you're a high school and you have math teachers who just don't have the math background that they need, maybe they majored in something else, they're certified in something else, well, it's going to be very difficult to build that math background in a short period of time through instructional frameworks and professional development. I mean, honestly, there's no shortcut to taking advanced math classes as a college or graduate student and developing that background that way. So if that's the kind of thing that we're looking at, instructional frameworks probably aren't the right tool. We want to look at things that we can influence with our resources within a reasonable span of time and also within our scope of authority. You know, if we have mandated curriculum or other kind of policies that constrain what we can do, you know, we want to focus on things that we can control and things that we can influence so that we can see improvements to practice as a result of this work. Now, in this particular module, we're not going into the entire process of developing instructional frameworks, but hopefully you've gotten enough of a flavor of how they work and how they can benefit teachers in growing their practice. And if you want to learn more, please do check out Mapping Professional Practice, which is my book with Heather Bell Williams on developing instructional frameworks. And we have a program where we guide you through that process called Evidence-Driven Growth Pathways. So check that out in your dashboard. In the next and final section of this module, we'll look at your portfolio task for Module 2, and I'm going to ask about your teacher evaluation criteria, as well as any areas where you're thinking of developing a custom instructional framework. So I'll see you there. Let's talk now about your Module 2 portfolio task, sending us your evaluation criteria for import into repertoire, and planning any custom instructional frameworks that you want to develop. Now, in the last module, I asked you to think about your evaluation criteria and think through how they fulfill the different accountability roles, how they provide perhaps performance accountability, some process accountability, and maybe some outcome accountability. At this point, what I'd like you to do is actually send us your evaluation criteria if you have not done so yet. And what we're going to do with those criteria is import them for you as snippets into repertoire. So all you have to do is send us a link or a file, whatever format you have them in, send those to info@principalcenter.com, and we will set them up as snippets in your repertoire account, so that you can start using them for all the purposes that we talked about in this module. You can use them as you observe. You can pin them on the screen in repertoire and take notes with those criteria in mind. You can use those criteria as you write your observation reports. You can use them as you talk with teachers about their practice and about what you saw in your observations. You can just constantly be using that vocabulary of your evaluation criteria. And of course, you can use them as you prepare final evaluations. And all of that is true for custom frameworks that you develop as well. So the second part of your portfolio task for this module is to think through some ideas for specific instructional frameworks that you might want to develop to take advantage of growth opportunities that either your whole staff or individual teachers have, as we talked about in the last couple of sections, using those four criteria. So what I'd like you to do for that response is just do a little bit of a video reflection and let me know, what are you thinking about developing criteria on? And if you're not ready to move forward with actually building a framework at this time, you don't have to, but I would love to work with you on that. I'd love to help you choose a focus and develop a framework. And if you're ready to move forward on that, you can book an appointment with me at justinscalendar.com and we will talk. So send in your video response, let me know what you're thinking about. And if you're ready, go ahead and book an appointment at justinscalendar.com. Then make sure you check all of those tasks as complete in our dashboard, and I will see you in Module 3.